You know, I've got a ton of things to keep track of every single day during a live show. Topics, guests, ins and outs. And I use Post-it Extreme Notes all day long for all of that vital information.
If you work on a hot, dusty job site or in a loud, wet kitchen, you know how tough it can be to communicate clearly. But now with new Post-it Extreme Notes, you can get that message across and you can get that job done in any weather condition, including rain, heat, and humidity. I'm talking in any element whatsoever. New Post-it Extreme Notes are water resistant. They're made with DuraHold paper and adhesive, so they'll stick to pretty much anything at all. Concrete, drywall, raw wood, even brick. So no matter what the task is on that job site, you can get that message across with new Post-it Extreme Notes. Again, communication is everything. You can't lead if you can't communicate. You've got to get your message across. Do it with new Post-it Extreme Notes. Buy them today wherever you get your Post-it notes. New Post-it Extreme Notes.
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Cleveland-Boston Game 5. Last night's Game 5 did answer the question. It answered the question. Question being, is it too much to ask to have two exciting conference finals games in a 24-hour span? The answer, of course, is yes. It was way too much to ask because Boston's 96-83 win was not exciting. It was actually pretty boring. And don't get me wrong. Boston's good. Boston's nice. Jason Tatum is becoming a star right before our eyes. That 24-7-4 performance in Game 5 of the Conference Finals when he turned 20 less than 3 months ago is macho as hell. But let's not confuse his great performance with that being a great game, because that was not a great game. Far from it. I mean, Boston did what they do at home in the playoffs. They won. Cleveland did what they do on the road in this series. They disappear. I mean, I don't get it at all. The home team has won in a blowout in 5 straight games. I don't understand that. I mean, I know there's somewhat of a home court advantage, but it's not like it was back in the old days when every arena was weird and funky and creaky and you had to travel by train and the Boston Garden had terrible visitors' locker rooms, dead spots on the floor, cold water coming out of the showers. It's not like that anymore. Teams charter jets. They stay in 5-star hotels. And the arenas are pretty much all fairly modern. In other words, there is no excuse for Cleveland no-showing the way that they just did. Again. And it's not good enough to just say, well, it's a road game. And that explains that. Because it doesn't. It doesn't explain how they shot less than 27% from the three. It does not explain how Kevin Love was 2-for-7 from deep. Jordan Clarkson, 2-for-7 from deep. J.R. Smith, 0-for-4 from deep. 1-of-6 overall. 2 points. 2 points. Tristan Thompson, 1 point. George Hill, 7 points. I can do the math for you. Hell, Hawk could even do that math. 3 guys in the Cavs starting lineup had 10 points. Not each. 3 starters combined for 10 points. Right. The simple math says 10 points combined for 3 starting players. But that's just Cleveland doing what Cleveland does when they're not in Cleveland. And LeBron finally did what he never does. He got tired. He looked tired. He was tired. For a second, it looked like leading the league in minutes in his 15th season, and then leading the league in minutes in the playoffs, and having to strap an entire team on his back and carry them through the first 2.5 rounds of the postseason may have finally caught up to this guy. Maybe. Possibly. Probably. Hey, if I'm LeBron, and I see 3 of my teammates in the starting lineup combined for 10 points, I'm just going to nap it out right there on the floor. You know, just kind of curl up on the parquet and get some shut-eye. Because that's clearly what the rest of his crew is doing. How is it possible to have 3 guys combined for 82 minutes and manage just 10 points? LeBron still had 26. He had 10 rebounds. He had 5 assists. And he shot 50% from the field. And he was not going to admit that he was tired, even if you know he was tired.
I had my moments. But I think everybody at this point is tired. Worn down or whatever the case may be.
All right, so right when he's on the verge, right when the guy is on the verge of admitting that he was tired, he completely rejected the whole notion.
I'm fine. And I didn't mention the fatigue either. One of you guys did. I'm fine.
Well, it doesn't matter who mentioned it. there's a chance that it might be a factor. Hey, look, I don't care if a guy's 35 or 25. Given that workload and the fact that he's got to carry the other four guys on his back like a piano up and down that court every single night, that would gas anybody out, including the guy who spends upwards of seven figures annually on taking care of his moneymaker. That's not on LeBron. And knowing that there might be the possibility that the cyborg that goes by the name LeBron James may be in need of a charging station, if there was ever a game to make sure that the shot-blocking, three-point shooting machine, Kyle Korver, got plenty of minutes, then it had to be last night. But he only played 19 minutes and didn't even enter the game until the second quarter. And by then, the Cavs were already getting blown out. So it's pretty confusing, right? Well, don't look for Ty Lue to make it any less confusing when he went to explain it.
Rotation seemed a little jumbled. Kyle didn't play in the first quarter, and Kevin and LeBron were on the bench to start the fourth. Did something get out of whack for you, or is that the way you wanted it to go?
Well, initially he's been putting Olajay in, so that's been kind of Kyle's matchup when he comes in the game. But he didn't play him tonight, so, you know, it kind of, you know, threw us for a loop. But we got Bron out with 2.5 minutes, and I started the fourth. He wasn't ready to go, so, you know, same thing happened game, I think, one or two. I can't remember.
Left side.
Brad Stevens not playing? Semi Ojeleye threw you for a loop? What does that even mean? What's that got to do with anything at all? Look, I love Ty Lue. I love Ty Lue. Ty Lue has forgotten a hell of a lot more basketball than I'll know in my whole lifetime. But if I'm him, I'm not going to explain my moves based on what Ojeleye did. Since when did Semi Ojeleye become the determining factor in anything? I know teams like to play matchups, but if we're matching up with Ojeleye now, I mean, come on. Don't get me wrong. Nice-ish kind of player, but not exactly somebody I'm building my entire game plan around. I'm not trying to scheme against Ojeleye. How did Ty Lue, who seemed to come up with a scheme in Game 3 and Game 4 to get his guys going and lock up Al Horford, just get turned inside out by Ojeleye? Look, I know Brad Stevens is a genius, but can he also do mind control? Did somebody on the Cavs coaching staff really say, you know, it'd be great to have Kyle Korver out there, one of the all-time great three-point shooters, but damn, Shemmy's not out there, so we can't do it. I mean, does that mean that if Stevens does not play Marcus Morris, that you're not going to play LeBron? If I'm Stevens, I try that in Game 6 just to see what happens, because as weird as this series has been, that might actually work. And as boring as this series has been, it might actually be interesting. John Morosi is my guest. John, good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, I'm doing great, and the ghostwriter line in my bio is probably the most cherished of all, and I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, you got it. You earned that. Listen, because of your versatility, John, I could start anywhere, but why don't we start with the Vegas Golden Knights? You were covering them during the conference finals, and you cover pretty much every sport, and you speak nearly every language on earth, so I have to ask first, have you ever seen a story like Vegas, going from not having a roster 12 months ago to being four wins away from the Stanley Cup right now?
Jim, it's incredible, and it is, in my opinion, a singular story in the modern history of pro sports in our country. It is to that level, because no one saw this coming. The hockey experts did not see it coming. The people even in the organization would not have said this was realistic when the season began. And so I think that as much as obviously they've beaten a number of really quality teams to get to where they're at right now in the Stanley Cup Final, and even, I would hope, hockey fans in those markets, the ones that lost to the Golden Knights, can appreciate what's happening here. This is a remarkable story of a well-constructed team that was even perhaps better constructed than the Golden Knights themselves even realized at the time, and then so well coached by Gerard Gallant. And it's one of the great stories in this context of sports, Jim, because a number of players have just gotten opportunities that did not otherwise exist for them. Hockey is so much based on ice time, opportunity, how many shifts you get, how many offensive zone starts you get, and you're seeing skilled players like William Karlsson and Jonathan Marchessault and Riley Smith and Nate Schmidt on the back end getting confidence, getting opportunity, and thriving on this stage collectively. And they really, truly did bond together as a city and a community. since the events of 1 October, right at the very beginning of their season. And to see this group of men from all around the world come together and represent their city so well, it was inspiring to cover, Jim, and I just cannot wait to see what happens next in the story.
Have you ever thought about how many steps there are between you and grubbing when you go out to the grocery store for your food? Driving, parking, finding all your items, standing in line, bagging up, loading up, unloading. Yeah, no thanks. How would you like to shop for organic groceries without paying top dollar? You can bypass those overpriced local markets and shop at Thrive Market. I love Thrive Market. They have everything you need, whether your diet's paleo, gluten-free, vegan, kosher, and even personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, safe and non-toxic beauty products, organic baby food, kids products, and more. In fact, much, much more. Anything you need. Click on a product and you'll see things like why you'll love it, price comparisons to retail, nutritional information, and more. So you can shop knowing that you are getting the best ingredients, the most affordable prices, and that it's all safe for your family. And best of all, Thrive Market's prices are already up to 50% off, and now they're giving you an extra $60 in free groceries plus free shipping. Get $60 of free organic groceries plus free shipping and a 30-day trial. You got to move on this right now. Go to thrivemarket.com/Rome. That's thrivemarket.com/Rome. John Morosi joining us. You know, John, you mentioned a number of guys, and there's so many different players that you could highlight on that team. But what do you make of the players deciding that Derek Englund would be the guy to accept the Campbell Bowl if they beat Winnipeg? And what has he meant to that team?
He has been so important, and I'm glad you asked about him, Jim, because he is someone that actually played minor league hockey in Las Vegas prior to becoming a Golden Knight. He actually debuted very late in his 20s in the National Hockey League. So he was somebody that had to spend year after year after year in the minor leagues and then finally break through. He's one of those respected voices in the room, probably the most respected one. And I spoke to him actually after Game 5, and I could tell how much it meant to him. When you get that distinction of being either a captain or an acting captain, and again, the Golden Knights don't have a captain, but he played that role in accepting the Campbell Bowl from Bill Daly. When you are the person that does that, it is, in the sport of hockey, I think, probably more meaningful than any other sport that we cover here on a regular basis in our country. It is a title of great honor, and he embodies that with his selflessness, and it certainly was the very first night of the season. Following the events of 1 October, he was the one that took the microphone and spoke to the fans at T-Mobile Arena. So he was the one who began that relationship by speaking so eloquently that night. And now he's the one that actually accepts the Campbell Bowl. And I'm sure, should they win the Stanley Cup, he'll be the one that puts his hands on that first as well. So it's an amazing story of perseverance for him and for his family. And I actually spoke to him as well, Jim, in the last week about what it meant for him as a Vegas resident to see what's happened in that community for hockey, where the Learn to Skate programs have gone from very small numbers to extraordinarily high numbers of kids enrolling. And I'll never forget, Jim, as long as I walk this earth, being at that community rink where they have their practice rink there in Summerlin, Nevada, outside of Vegas, and having fans only being allowed to go in 10 or 12 at a time to just go into the souvenir shop to buy souvenirs and gear on a Wednesday morning, Jim. It's a weekday morning, and they're there lined up out the door because of the fire code. It was just remarkable to see that, and no one can question the authenticity or the true passion that Vegas fans have for their team now after seeing what we've seen now the last several weeks.
John Morosi, my guest. Honestly, John, I've never seen or heard anything like that ever before. You mentioned the Campbell Bowl. Fact is, no team has touched the Campbell Bowl since 2004. So what do you make of the decision to not only touch it, but to lift it and skate around with it?
Yeah, it was really interesting to see that. I the two things. Number one, I love the fact that here you have a first-year franchise. So really, when you think about it, what place does the superstition and tradition really have to govern the actions of a first-year franchise? That's one part. But actually, what Englund told me and why he actually decided to touch it was that Marc-Andre Fleury, formerly of the Penguins and who has been their best player in these playoffs, clearly in goal, Fleury, in 2008, Sidney Crosby did not touch the Prince of Wales Trophy, and the Penguins lost to the Red Wings in the Stanley Cup Final. So the next year, to change up their luck, Sidney Crosby touched the trophy. And then the Penguins did it again in 16 and won it. They did it in 17 and won it. So for Marc-Andre Fleury personally, he had seen it happen more times, actually 3-0 his teams are when they touch the conference championship trophy. And so Fleury and told England, hey, it's always worked for me. I've seen it work this way. Let's do it for us. And England basically said, hey, if it was good enough for Marc-Andre Fleury, it was good enough for me. So that was Fleury was the inspiration, and again, fitting based on his inspired play during these playoffs.
And then Ovechkin did it again last night. John Morosi, my guest. John, I had GM George McPhee on this program earlier this week. I could not be any more impressed with how he's not only built this roster and the culture, but how he's handling all of this success. You spoke with him after winning that series. So what do you make of the job he's done?
Extraordinary. And I think that, Jim, there's some conversation, some line of criticism out there that, oh, well, the rules of the expansion draft were favorable to Vegas. I'm not buying that.
Right.
I think that they were fair, and then George McPhee made a lot of excellent moves. And when you ask him, as I know you did, and I'm sure he said in response, he always credits the work of his scouts and his front office staff. And spending that year when the Vegas Golden Knights existed as an organization but not as a team on the ice, they were working and seeing as many pro games as they could everywhere, and he made a lot of great decisions. He got Alex Tuch, who's become the second-line player for them and a really reliable power forward and scorer, who was unprotected by the Wild and had played only six NHL games, I believe, before this season. You had players that he and his scouts developed, an expertise on even beyond what other teams had about their own players, that being Carlson, Marchessault, Smith, Schmidt, and Fleury, of course, was the known commodity, and I think we can't underestimate the fact that that was maybe the one bit of good fortune, that Fleury was that name-brand goaltender who was clearly out there where a team had two good goalies, they were only going to be able to keep one of them, and the Penguins were never able to find that trade partner anywhere else to get Fleury off their roster before the expansion draft to get something back for him. So that was really a key thing there, which really makes you wonder, Jim, how many other teams around the league would have rather traded for Fleury before the expansion draft had they known he was going to bounce back in the way that he did. But McPhee, I got to tell you, I know you had the same experience. He, of course, also built the Capitals in large part, and now he's going to play that team in the Stanley Cup Final. But he is so humble about that. He didn't want to engage in any sort of, well, I'm going to prove them or anything like that. He is too classy to do that. So he's such an impressive executive and really, I think, an extraordinary architect and a great one of the great faces of hockey now in Las Vegas.
You're right, John. When I brought that up with him, that's exactly how he handled that question. So now he is going to face the Capitals. I know that you've been focused on the Western Conference and on baseball, but what are your early thoughts on that matchup?
It's going to be extraordinary. One of the faster Stanley Cup Finals we've ever seen, I believe. The Vegas Golden Knights play fast, and we saw, I think, with the Capitals game as it evolved during the course of the playoffs, they can play fast as well. And I think you've got two great, unmistakably great stories colliding, I believe, in the Stanley Cup Final, Jim, because you've got the extraordinary nature of the Golden Knights, the most successful expansion franchise in North American pro sports history, period, even right now. Even if they never win another game, they're still the most successful expansion franchise we have ever seen, period. And then you've got, on the other side, Ovechkin. And finally stamping in the minds of whatever critics remain, and I certainly was not among them, but anybody that doubted, okay, well, can he win a big game? What can he do to lead his team? Well, last night, 62 seconds into the game, boom, goal, Capitals win, lead 1-0 on the road in Game 7, and they go on to win that game 4-0. So to me, to see one of the all-time greats, I think it's an unmistakable storyline for us that when you've got an all-time great player finally chasing that Stanley Cup and finally having an opportunity in the Cup Final, I'm not going to say it's the same level as LeBron when he first got his first opportunity, but it's something similar to that in the context of this sport. So it's a powerful story. Ovechkin has earned it, and he really, I think, proved a lot of naysayers wrong with his performance there in Game 7. So that was the perfect scene-setter and tone-setter for the Stanley Cup Final.
John Morosi joining us for a few more moments. You know, John, you're essentially the only person in our business that I can pose this question to. But from a journalist standpoint, how similar or different is it when you're covering hockey versus covering baseball?
Great question, Jim. There are certainly some differences. I love the fact that both sports are so international. I love that as you're waiting for off-ice interviews in the Stanley Cup playoffs, you're standing next to the French networks from Canada and other global networks that have come in from Europe, from Finland and Sweden to cover the playoffs. So I love that. It's similar to being around Japanese media and Korean media and Latin American media during the baseball playoffs, which I really love. I think that the players, I'll say one thing about hockey, they are almost always going to give you a better quote when you ask them about their teammates than themselves. The classic hockey quote is always, well, my teammate put it right on my tape, or it was a rebound and I had the easy part. They will almost always say that. So I want to try to maybe get a little more reflection out of them by talking about those that have helped them get there. I think that's one of the great questions that I know I hear all the time on Hockey Night in Canada. Scott Oak is one of the best in the business, and he really poignantly always asks that question in a very unique way about the people that have helped you get there. So I think that's a really great story. Both sports involve moving away from home at an early age. They can be really challenging in that regard, and so I always appreciate the journey and try my best, I guess, to ask them about the people that have helped them get there, because when you leave the Dominican Republic at 16 or you leave a home in Canada or the U.S. at 16 to go play junior hockey, it's a great sacrifice, and I think it really results in a very unique life story.
It's a really interesting point, John. Why do you think that is? Why is it that in the NHL or in hockey, that's the one group of athletes that will always point to the other guy? Ask about the guy in the room. Why is that sport different, and why is that generally the response in that sport?
It's a really good question, Jim, and I think, much like baseball, maybe I'll put it this way, that in basketball, that you may have an odd game where Curry struggles or LeBron struggles, but for the most part, the superstars at this level, they're going to put up their numbers pretty consistently. If you've got a star running back in the NFL, a star quarterback, unless they have a completely awful day, they're still going to throw for 200 or 300 yards, or the run for 100 maybe thereabouts. LeBron's going to get at least 25 in a big game. But in hockey, you can play and do all the right things, but if the ball doesn't bounce your, or the puck doesn't bounce your way in hockey, you may have a 7-game goalless series and still play really well. So I think that humility of the success not being guaranteed is just baked into the way that you have to operate, so that way you don't get too expectant about success. I think baseball is the same way, especially now with all the shifting. This is true, I think, for all players. You could scald, Mike Trout could scald the ball 4 times, but if the defense is played exactly right and shifted into his hot zones, and it's 4 line drives into the second baseman's glove or the shortstop's glove, you did everything right. You hit line drives, but you failed. And so I think that baseball and hockey are similar in that regard, that the relatively low rate of success. You score 25 goals in the NHL, you're an amazing player. And that's obviously a much lower total than what you're going to score points in basketball or yards in football. So I think it's maybe just the construct of the game and how elusive success can be even when you do everything right.
You know, cops are out there looking more and more intently than ever before for drivers and passengers who are not buckled up. If you've thought to yourself, I'm not going very far, or I'm in a rush, or seatbelts are just too uncomfortable, then know this. You're putting yourself at the risk of injury or death. There is never a good excuse not to buckle up, because it's always dangerous to not wear your seatbelt when you get behind the wheel of a car. You know the saying. Now make it a household rule to live by. Click it or ticket. How is this not automatic at this point? When you're not wearing your seatbelt, you're risking serious injury or death. It's a fact. Cops are writing tickets, so don't take the risk. Don't play the odds. Again, let me say it so it sticks. Click it or ticket. There is no excuse not to buckle up. Get it done. I just want to put a hockey topic out there, too. We've talked about this team throughout the entire postseason. They did it. The Capitals, they did the damn thing. They did it.
We did it!
That wasn't easy, was it? It wasn't easy because there's no way that the Washington Capitals would make it easy. But after they've been counted out so many times in this postseason alone, they are on their way to the Stanley Cup Final now. They lost the first 2 games of the first round at home to the Blue Jackets. Remember that? They were down 0-2, going back to Columbus. And not only did it look like they were not going to reach the Stanley Cup Final, it looked like they were not even going to make it out of mid-April. They get hammered early. Head coach Barry Trotz probably would have been gone. And then they'd have to take a nice long look, a hard look at their roster. They'd have to bust that thing up. It didn't work. But then they win Game 3 in Columbus, and they do it in overtime. Then they rip off 3 more in a row. So from down 0-2 to winning in 6, the Caps actually had momentum. Then they blew it in Game 1 of the Pittsburgh series by squandering a late lead once again. And it looks like same old Caps. But then they battle back. They beat their playoff nemesis in 4 of the next 5 games. So all of a sudden, we're all thinking, they're not the same Caps. Then they steamroll Tampa in the first 2 games of the conference finals. And it looked like the team finally had arrived. They're finally on their way. Self-actualization. This is the team we've been waiting for. But then again, nothing for the Caps is ever easy. So they lose the next three. They're hanging by a thread going into Game 6, and it looks like they're going to have the most Cap-like implosion ever. All they do then is win Game 6 3-0, setting up last night's Game 7 in Tampa. When, to be honest with me, Caps fan, you were expecting them to no-show. You were expecting them to bring you this close to get within 60 minutes of a look at the Cup and then completely mess the bed, fall apart on the big stage. But they didn't. Not only did they not fall apart, they came out on fire. 62 seconds into the game, Ovi did this.
A hit at center as Kunitz was hit shoulder to shoulder by Tom Wilson. Ahead on the right side, and now Kuznetsov across to Ovechkin. He scores! He scores! 1 minute and 2 seconds into Game 7. The Great Eight has made it 1-0 Washington!
Holy crap. Now that's how you start a Game 7 on the road. That's how you start a Game 7 on the road. With Tom Wilson decking a fool and Ovechkin lighting the lamp. That's Capital Hockey right now. Beat the crap out of you and then score on you. And if you didn't know that that was their plan, then your name must be Braden Coburn. Because after Coburn and Wilson were sent to the box for 2 minutes each in the first period, the second their time was up, these guys come right out and they drop gloves immediately and they go right back at it. Now, that's the kind of fight that you don't see very often in the playoffs, especially in Game 7. But you know Wilson was not going to back down, and you know Wilson was not going to lose either.
The lane closed quickly, and now a fight as Coburn and Wilson are going to drop the mitts as they come out of the penalty box. Little surprising this would carry over given the stakes tonight, but both seem to be pretty incensed. Fighting majors here in the first period of Game 7. Wilson and Coburn continuing, and as Wilson coming after him with a couple of lefts and a little spin move and all of this center stage, and then Wilson ends up with a takedown at the end.
I cannot stress enough how surprising that would be, or at least ordinarily. Game 7? Conference Finals? These guys come right out of the box and go looking for each other. And if Coburn were looking to get his team fired up, then that backfired. Because instead he got his face crushed. And the Caps kept on rolling. Two more goals in the second. They go up 3-0. And by that point, the only suspense was, what would the final score be and whether Ovechkin would touch the Prince of Wales trophy? Final score 4-0. And just like that, you can write the Capitals into the Stanley Cup Final, and you can erase all your thoughts about the same old Caps, because this Caps crew had chance after chance to show that they were the same old Caps, and they didn't. They didn't fold, they didn't give up, they didn't give in. An amazing job. And now they're on to the final. Want to look years younger in just minutes?
Experience Control GX from Just for Men, the first shampoo with a brain. So what makes it so smart? It reduces gray the same way it grows in, gradually. The more you shampoo with Control GX, the less gray you have. Just use it until you like what you see. Now, how smart is that? Smart enough to be voted Men's Hair Care Product of the Year. Gradually reduce gray with the first shampoo with a brain. Find Control GX in the shave aisle. That's Control GX.
My guest is Chad Millman. Chad, it's great to have you on the program. How are you?
I'm good. Good to be with you. This is awesome.
Chad, this is awesome. Great to have you on. I've been looking forward to talking to you. Let me first ask you, what was your reaction when you heard the news of the Supreme Court's decision regarding sports gambling? What was the first thing that went through your mind?
Oh my God, I can't believe this happened. That was exactly it. Not because the Supreme Court ruled that I had a feeling when they decided to take the case a year ago in the summer that they had something to say, that they would like to think that I was thinking that they probably wanted to figure out a way to overturn some component of the federal betting ban. But I think what was shocking, and this is what was shocking to everybody who's been handicapping this case, for lack of a better term, was that they overturned the entire federal betting ban, which that was really unexpected. It sort of opened the floodgates on what's possible in this space from a content perspective, from a business perspective, for bookmakers, from a state perspective. for revenue generation. It turned it into a much bigger business.
These are all relevant points, all pertinent questions. But let me ask you this. I mean, there's the option that there could be federal regulation of sports gambling. How likely is that, or do you think that Congress is just going to leave it up to the states?
I think that Congress will eventually enact federal legislation. And the reason is twofold. One, they are going to get lobbied so hard. It is only a massive business if the biggest players in the market have the opportunity to capitalize on it. And we're talking about places like William Hill, which is a huge bookmaker overseas that for the past 10 years has been buying sports books all over Nevada, as well as getting ready to buy to implement sports books in New Jersey and Delaware. Places like Paddy Power, which just made a deal to buy the draft fantasy, the daily fantasy site FanDuel, to get a foothold into that market and use their customers to convert them into sports bettors. Plus the leagues, they can only make a ton of money if it's nationally, if it's federally regulated. And the media companies, they stand to benefit because the larger entities that I just mentioned in the bookmaking space, they're the ones who are going to go and spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year on advertising to reach customers. And it's harder to do all of that if you have to geo-target. If you're running ads on Monday Night Football and you got to figure out, all right, I want to get bettors in New York, but I can't get bettors in New Jersey. I can't get people in New Jersey because it's not legal there. It just makes it a lot more complicated and dirtier from a business perspective.
Chad Millman joining us. All right, Chad, so if we look at how big this business can be, as an example, how much money are we talking about in legalized sports gambling right now, and then how much do you expect that to grow as a result of this decision?
Well, I think if you're talking about it from two places. One, the handle on legalized sports betting, I mean, the total number of bets made legally in the United States, is really only in the state of Nevada, and that's in the $4.5 billion range. I forget exactly what the handle is, but it's $4 to $5 billion last year was bet. Not a huge amount when you compare it to, say, the $172 as much as $400 billion market that everyone estimates this is when you think about the illegal bets made. So you transition that, obviously, with right now, the only state that's really ready to go after this, other than Nevada, is New Jersey, and then you have Delaware, and I think very soon, probably by football season, if they can get it right, you've got New York. Clearly, it's not going to go from $5 billion legal market to $170 billion legal market with adding those three states, but what you are going to get is an increased activity around the marketing, and just overseas, think about what's happening in Australia and what's happening in England. Those places, the influx of cash from the larger businesses, from the bookmakers and everyone else who's trying to reach customers is a multi-billion dollar. We're talking, you know, high billion-dollar market, $9 billion, $10 billion market. In the United States, imagine how much bigger that's going to be.
Chad Millman joining us. Now, Chad, before I ask you how you ended up where you are right now, let me ask you this. Given the numbers you just laid out, how much will the expansion of legalized gambling impact the way people watch and engage with games?
I think it's massive, Jim. I mean, you think about the number of people, there was a study, the number of games people watch, the number of NFL games people watch when they don't bet on sports in a standard season is 15. An average number of games people watch when they do bet on sports is more than 40. The time that people engage with sports when they bet on those games is 40% higher than it is with people who don't bet on sports. So what you're going to be getting is just an audience that is significantly happier to be watching these games. They're going to be watching them for longer. They're going to want to watch more of them. It's going to change the way people are covering these games because they want to capture that audience. I mean, honestly, look at fantasy. Fantasy has become such a huge driver of people's attention on a Sunday afternoon that all the networks are building programming specifically around engaging that fantasy fan.
We're talking to Chad Millman. So, Chad, then, in terms of your personal story, the road to becoming the head of media for the Action Network to me is fascinating. How did you first get interested and then start gaining knowledge about sports gambling?
So I was at ESPN forever. I was at ESPN for the better part of 20 years, from 98 until 2017. And the only time I wasn't at ESPN was in 1999, I was an editor at the magazine, and I wrote a story for the magazine about the guys who set the point spreads for the NCAA tournament. It was a bunch of bookmakers at the Stardust Hotel on the Strip in Las Vegas, and this was before the Internet had become sort of the predominant mover of lines and maker of lines. So anything that happened in sports betting happened first at the Stardust. And it was a multi-billion dollar industry that was being sort of predicated and built on the point spreads these bookmakers were making. And so I talked to them for the NCAA tournament, thought it was fantastic, and then asked them if I could write a book about them and sort of their interplay with professional gamblers over the course of the college basketball season. And that book was called The Odds. And I spent the 99-2000 season in Vegas sort of tracking one professional bettor who was considered the best college basketball handicapper in the world at the time, and the bookmakers, and seeing how sort of lines moved and sort of the small details that impacted this huge, huge, what I call the parallel conversation that we're all having about sports. I did that and then just sort of went back to the magazine and became an editor, but along the way I was writing a column about sports betting for ESPN.com, and then I started a podcast about sports betting for ESPN Audio and was doing television, and so it all sort of morphed into something bigger. And then I had, you know, I was editor-in-chief of the magazine and editorial director of ESPN Digital, and made gambling a central part of our coverage. And so when the folks who started the Action Network were looking for someone to help build their content space, they called me. And to be honest, like, this was, you know, last summer, fall, and you could see the landscape changing pretty aggressively. And while I was very happy at ESPN, and it's a great life, I felt like if I was ever going to, you know, make a bet, it was going to be in this space with the people who started the Action Network, and that was the Churning Group.
Chad Millman's my guest. So you made a big bet. Chad, help me with this now, and you can set me straight. Tell me if this is a breach in etiquette or a breach in protocol, but if we're talking about making bets, right, what's the biggest bet you ever laid? Now, you might say, well, this, I gave up an amazing job at ESPN. But aside from that, the biggest actual bet you've ever made, what was it?
It was, I can tell you exactly what it was. And I've never made sort of, I've never tried to hide this. I am not a massive bettor. Like, to me, what I love about this area is, like, the language is really interesting and visceral and emotional. I love the characters. I love the parallel conversation. I think it's really influential. I love the math and the psychology. But the biggest bet I ever made, it was $300, and it was on. It was actually when I was reporting the book and I was doing the odds in Vegas, and I had bet on Utah State to cover against Connecticut. They were 9-point dogs in the NCAA tournament, and they were covering the whole game. And in the last 2 minutes, all the scrubs came in. UConn was winning by like 8 or 10 points, and the scrubs came in, and UConn made a bucket, and they were up by 11 with about 3 or 4 seconds left. And then Rick Mahorn's nephew, I think, was on Utah State. He came in off the bench, and he launched a 3-pointer from about between half court and the 3-point line, and it went in. And so they covered. The spread was 9. They lost by 8. I won that $300 bet, and I was so happy. And then I looked over to my right, and the guy I wrote this book about picked up the phone and put $100,000 back in play, because that's how much he had just won on that shot.
Wow.
And that put everything I was doing in perspective.
That's insane. All right, so when you talk to these people and you wrote that book, what's the more intense feeling, the big win or the bad beat?
Oh, the bad beat. I mean, the bad beat is just, it wrecks people, because they think about all the things that went wrong. They think about the call. They think about the shot. They think about the missed tackle. I mean, and look, we do something on actionnetwork.com where we're writing about the bad beats every single day, because it's like a traffic accident. And, you know, people can't stop but watch and see what happened. And you don't write about the big wins, because the flip side of those is somebody won a game like that, but it's not as exciting, and it's like a bad golf game, right? Like, bettors love to wallow in sort of their own misery, and they love to share these stories in a way that is really emotional. And so when you write about a bad beat, it gets tons and tons of traction, and that's how bettors sort of view the world.
It's almost like it hurts so much, it almost feels good. It doesn't feel good, but having owned horse races, I've been on the wrong end of some bad beats, and it feels so horrible that it's kind of like when that feeling's not there, you kind of miss it. Let me finally ask you this. For the Action Network, how much of the content that you provide your subscribers is like straight data, straight intel, and then how much of it is entertainment-based? In other words, you know you're going to get the people who love gambling. Does it appeal to a casual player as well?
Yes. It's probably about 40%, here's hardcore stuff that you want to subscribe for that is driven by our data and our tools and our analytics and our analysis that says, here's who you want to play tonight and why. Or these are the reasons why we think you should bet on this series or you shouldn't bet or which direction you should go. But the stories that we're finding like that really resonate with people and that capture the biggest audience, it's like, Jason Sobel, who's one of our writers, who's probably the premier golf writer in the country and was at ESPN for 20 years, he wrote a phenomenal story about the night he lost a bet to Phil Mickelson on a boxing match, and that Mickelson had set up this huge party for everybody to come watch this fight and casually dropped, hey, if anybody wants to bet on this fight with me, I'm taking action. And like half the room did it. Clearly, they were all suckered by Mickelson because he knew what was going to – He had studied that fight. He had handicapped that fight, and nobody else had done it. Like another story that tracked really well for us was Paul LaDuca, who was a major league catcher for 10 years. And you know from sort of the horse business, like he's a massive follower of the horses and has been for years. And so he was an four-time All-Star, but he wrote a story for us about winning $80,000 on the Kentucky Derby and watching the race from the clubhouse when he was playing for the Marlins and getting called out to the field by a clubby, by a clubhouse kid, because the umpire was waiting for him to come to the plate to take his at-bat, but he was watching the race to see if he was going to win $80,000. And he won the race, won $80,000, raced up to the home plate, was out of breath, told the catcher, just throw me a fastball. I'm going to slap this to short. We're going to get out of this inning because I just won $80,000. And that's exactly what happened. And so, you know, we very much try to traffic in the stories that we know are going to resonate with the widest audience possible because, I mean, as you know, people just want to hear good stories, and people are fascinated by stories that involve money and risk. And those are always going to be winners, and you don't need to be a bettor in order to really enjoy reading or hearing about those things.
Bob Melvin is my guest. Bob, it's great to have you back. Thanks for doing it. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How are you?
Good, good. Skip, you dropped a tough game last night to the Mariners, 1-0. I know you're not thrilled with the result, but let me ask you about Daniel Gossett. He went 7 innings. He allowed 4 hits and an unearned run. That was his first start since coming back from Nashville. So starting right there, what did you make of what you saw from him last night?
Oh, I thought he was great. I mean, it's as good as we've seen him here, actually. You know, he's put together quite a season so far in AAA, and you know, we were down 2 starters coming out of spring. We lost 2 starters on the last road trip, so we really needed him to come up and perform. He did exactly that. We just couldn't get the bats going the last couple games.
All right, so what about that? The offense has scuffled a little bit of late. He had to place Chris Davis on the DL. He's got a groin strain. I mean, it's a long season. Stretches like that obviously are going to happen. So what's the key to getting through stretches like that and getting out of them?
Well, you know, obviously it hurts. I mean, he's like having a human sledgehammer in the middle of the lineup, and everybody kind of rallies around him. He takes the pressure off a lot of guys. But, you know, one, it gives an opportunity for somebody else. It allows us to move the DH spot around a little bit for some guys that maybe haven't gotten a lot of rest to this point. But the other flip side is we'd rather have him back in the lineup. So, you know, we just have to do it as a group, not put too much pressure on each guy. And know that he's going to be back. It's a grade 1 strain, so know that he's going to be back probably in 10 to 12 days and hold down the fort in the meantime.
A's manager Bob Melvin joins us. Now, when you and I spoke back in spring training, you had a pretty good feeling about this team. You're 50 games in, or nearly 50 games in. So what do you make of how the group has shown up so far, and has it been what you expected?
You know, it really kind of has. You know, it's you know, with our payroll, it's tough to withstand injuries. So we've had some injuries that have affected us, but you know, we felt like that this year we were going to trend in the right direction. You know, we just came off an East Coast trip where we went 7-3, and everybody was talking about this might be the undoing of us. So we felt good. We swung the bats really well. We came back home. We haven't swung the bats very well in the first 2 games here. So, We've been up and down a little bit, as it's going to be over the course of the season. But I think coming out of spring, if someone told us we were over 500 at this point, we'd probably take that because we feel like we have the ability to get better as the season goes along.
The thing is, though, not just a 7-3 road trip, but a 7-3 road trip where you had a four-game sweep of the Blue Jays and a road trip which included stops in New York, Boston, and Toronto. I mean, a road trip like that can be a real grind. 10 games, 10 days, and you went 7-3. So what did you guys show you about how they handled their business against some of the best in the league?
No doubt about it. I mean, it's once you go to the East Coast, you know you're gonna have your starters are gonna be taxed, your bullpen's gonna be taxed, and you're gonna have to score some runs. And we did exactly that. We lost two starters on the trip in two consecutive games, and had to cover 14 and two-thirds innings out of the bullpen 2 days in a row. A total of 14 and two-thirds. So we got contributions from guys across the board in the bullpen. We swung the bats well. That's what we feel like is going to be our strength. But going into that trip, boy, you know, you look at it and say 5-5, it'd be a decent trip to come out of it 7-3 was terrific.
A's manager Bob Melvin joins us. Now, the team also acquired Stephen Piscotty in a trade that was motivated by his desire to be close to his mother, Gretchen. After she was diagnosed with ALS, she passed away earlier this month. So as a manager and as a team, what's this experience been like? And then how do you go about trying to support him as he deals with that grief?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and you know, usually these things, you know, have a little shorter shelf life. This has been going on with him for quite a while, well over a year, and it's, you could tell it really wore on him. You know, you try to insulate as far as he goes within your team. These guys give him a lot of support and love. It's a really close group, and I think he feels it. You know, we gave him the option when he came back. He flew into Boston. He left early in the morning. We gave him the option. He wanted to play. He hits a home run his first at bat. It was like a bomb went off in the dugout. The guys were so excited for him. So, you know, it's just now trying to get back into the routine. He's still a young kid. He's a heck of a player. But, boy, we've had some heavy hearts here for quite a while for him.
Yeah, I mean, going back to that point, what a moment that must have been. Like he had a few games off in the week that she passed away, and then in that very first game back, he homered in his first at-bat. What was the moment like for the entire team when he did that?
Oh, it was amazing. Like I said, it felt like a walk-off in the dugout, and guys were, you know, we're just so happy to see him once he got there. He got up really early in the morning to make the flight and try to play in the game, and did a home run the first time. Shows he's got a little flair for the dramatic, but the guys were just so excited, and now we have him back full time, and you know, we feel like he's going to get better as the year goes along too.
You know, Bob, I've talked with managers of late, in fact the last couple of years, and the one thing that keeps coming up over and over again is a focus on having open and honest relationships with the players and how critical that is, especially over the course of a long, long season. So the question is, I mean, everybody knows it, but how do you go about developing those types of relationships?
Well, you know, it's just kind of gotten to that point now where you know, you even rely on guys for input. You know, there's certain few guys on this team that I'll ask, you know, from time to time, bring them in and talk to them, and not only about their personal lives, but, you know, what they think's going on. How can we get better? So you use these guys to kind of get a feel for the pulse of the team and how things are going. And it's just the way it was when I first came up, and, you know, I went to the Tigers in 1985. I was scared to even go talk to Sparky Anderson, who was our manager, let alone go have a conversation with him. So it really is different now. The younger players are getting to the big leagues even younger now. So you want to make sure what you know what makes them tick, and not only have a professional relationship, but with a personal relationship with them, because they feel like you're really invested in them if you do.
Hey, Bob, it's really great that you brought up Sparky Anderson like that, because even when I first got in the business and I was like a young guy on TV, I would have him in studio, and man, he was amazing. I mean, he was so charismatic and so gregarious, but most of all, approachable even to a media guy on the way up back in the day. I don't even know how to explain it. It was an amazing thing to see. What was Sparky like to play for?
He was great. I mean, I was just there for a short period of time. I really had better actual relationship with him when I was in the minor leagues. He used to come over to minor league camp. I was a guy in the Tiger system that was supposed to be an upcoming prospect, and man, he really made me feel good. Once you get to the big leagues, it's a little different, at least to start. But he really impacted my career before I even got to the big leagues, based on the fact that he knew, I felt like he knew who I was, and I felt like he was kind of invested in me.
Can you imagine what he must have dealt with in running that Reds clubhouse back in the day, the big red machine, the strong personalities and the guys, the Hall of Famers, and how strong they were. And then you look at your career. You wear number six right now, and the story goes that it's a tribute to Sal Bando, who taught you a lot when he was GM of the Brewers. What kind of things did you learn from him, and what did you respect the most about his approach?
Well, I followed him as a kid here, growing up in the Bay Area, and he was the captain of those Oakland A's teams that won the World Series, and he just kind of had that leadership aura about him. And then when he gave me my first opportunity as a non-player in the Milwaukee system, he showed me the entire gamut of how our organization was run. I was in player development. I was a bench coach with Phil Garner on the team. I was a special assistant to him. I did some minor league scouting stuff. He really moved me along quickly and let me know what everybody in an organization had to deal with. So, you know, you can see things from somebody else's shoes when you've been in all different facets of the organization. I thank him for that. He's a great man.
Bob, Phil Garner's another one. Scrap iron. God, he was so hard-nosed. How tough and hard-nosed a player was he?
He was. You know, I got to spend some time with him with the Giants in his last year. And, you know, formed a quick bond. I was a younger guy. He kind of took me under his wing some. And then, you know, when I got out of playing, I was with him, you know, in Milwaukee. I was with him in Detroit. And I take all my managerial chops. I mean, he's my guy. He's who I learned from. You know, when you have the protege mentor type thing, he is my guy. So we still communicate quite a bit. I always see him when we go to Houston. We had him here for a while in Oakland as kind of a special assistant to me. Just terrific people. Without Sal Bando and Phil Garner, there's no chance that I'm here where I am right now.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I haven't talked to him in a few years, they pay me not to play favorites. I love Phil Garner, one of my favorite guys. He was so great. Before you go, you're playing the Mariners today, and earlier this month it was announced that Ichiro was going to be taking a step back. You managed him early in his time with Seattle during that amazing 2004 season where he broke the single season hits record. What do you remember about that year?
Well, I know he got off to a tough start in April, and from May forward, it seems like he got three hits every night. How he prepares is unlike any player I've ever had. We're still really close. I had dinner over at his house when we were in Seattle last time and let me know kind of what was going on with him going forward here. But really and truly, all you had to let him know is what time the game was. He is, from the time he wakes up during the day to the time he goes to sleep, and when he gets up the next day, it's all about preparation to play a Major League Baseball game. And when you have somebody like him in his clubhouse, not only for the younger guys, but the veteran guys to see how he prepares, man, it really is special.
Yeah, Bob, the fact that he has dinner with you, he breaks bread with you, and when you consider how private he is, I got to ask, what are those dinners like? What do you guys talk about? What do you guys eat? What's an evening with Ichiro like?
You know, is that we go to dinner quite often during the course of the season, no matter where he is. But we went over to his house that day in Seattle, and you know, it really is easy to talk to him. His interpreter Alan's there, but we could have a conversation without an interpreter. He's that smart. But it's not all baseball. You know, we have some history. We, you know, kind of go over, you know, where he's lived and what his life experiences are. He's very inquisitive. My daughter was there with me, and he was very inquisitive to our relationship. Just a special guy and easy to talk to, and, you know, the relationship has gotten better and better over the years.
Good night now!